Welcome back to Pneumatic Materials. My name is Nate, and you're listening to episode 12, the second part of our conversation with the artist Sven Lovin, in which we dive further into the relationship between his spiritual and artistic practices. Let's get into it.
You didn't grow up in a explicitly religious household that, or you had room to explore?
I grew up in a bohemian household. Yeah. My parents, so I was never baptized. I went to an Episcopalian school as a child, but it was also in the West Village. So it was a church that was open to gay people. It was, progressive church. So I never really grew up as a Christian. Yeah. But studying philosophy and literature and Western thought has gotten me very acquainted with the history of Christianity, and I have a respect for it just through the philosophy, actually, and through the history of logos, which is an interesting subject, and how that seems kind of specific to Christian thought. So I give it respect to that, even though I tried, actually, I don't know if it was during the pandemic, but I tried praying to Christ and I didn't get a response.
Yeah, I think it's definitely the water you swim in. If you're learning about, you grow up in the West and you learn about Western philosophy, it's kind of just the premise that you have to at least be kind of familiar with in order to make sense of all this stuff.
Especially as an artist, just so much art is Christian. Yeah. So just to be able to interpret it, you have to know the stories.
Yeah, I studied art history and was abroad in Italy. And so I ended up knowing, all these saints because it's oh, he's the guy with the arrows in him. Oh, he's the guy on the grill. You just kind of put it together.
Yeah.
Particularly the ways that Christianity has preserved different ideas from previous Greco-Roman or schools of philosophy. The Trinity as a kind of, as a concept, it's a very advanced, philosophical or just from a conceptual perspective. And so I think it has a lot of interesting, thought experiments or ways of kind of conceiving of the world. But we're no longer in this space in a time where you are bound to these ideas. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they kind of have structured my unconscious in different ways of just being in that ambient. But I also kind of grew up going to church. Well, I went to church Christmas, Easter, that kind of thing. It was very much Reddit atheist by the time I was 12. And so it was only kind of through psychedelics, philosophy courses in college, whatever, that I came around to spirituality, mysticism in general. And I'm not really practicing of any specific, religious, set of practices, but
he's a Pastafarian.
I'm just kidding. Yeah,
I hate that. Sorry.
Yeah. Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster.
Sorry, all the Reddit references in the air. So.
Oh, God. I mean, that kind of, I think that is finally on its way out. I mean, nobody's getting a.
I saw it in the news recently. I mean, somebody successfully got their driver's license taken with the pot.
Oh. Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, maybe people are using it now, the Church of Satan. They're using it for civil rights, I hope.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not just to be edgelord atheists. It'd be better to
put a little flying spaghetti monster on the courthouse steps or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Have you read Robert Wilson?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Shit. Okay.
I actually haven't read that much of him. The Illuminati book.
Illuminatus trilogy.
Kind of interested in reading that.
It's hilarious. It actually was written 10 years before Foucault's Pendulum, which they're often compared. And, he's an interesting character for me because I had picked up Illuminatus without any, I was just like, I want a great piece of sci-fi. And
does it work that way?
Is it like that? No, it has all of the conspiracies plus all of the faiths. And then they take their invented religion of Discordianism, and they make it about that. And it's a kind of, it's a commentary in secret societies. It's a commentary on world power. Yeah. I like how they made it so, like, Hitler was actually hiding out in Israel as a Jew. Like, there's a lot of little jokes in the book, but he was a character that I remember. He was an editor at Playboy that's reaggregates all of this, these conspiracies. And it's someone that, like, when I was younger, I don't know if I looked up to him, but I respected it. I had also read his Circuits of Consciousness, you know, his other things for his life and some of his journals. But then I got a little older and I learned about his, like, relationship with intelligence. There it is again. And I think it was, like, very important for me to be like, oh, okay, this is another very interesting figure who's also a trickster, who also is, like, two truths and a lie. It's like,
what was his relationship to intelligence?
Okay. Him and Leary. And
yeah, like, the rumor is that, like, a lot of the Woodstock generation, like, a lot of that is just to subjugate people or, like,
yeah. Well, it's also taking a step back, that's to control the flow of counterculture. It's taking a very deep understanding of, like, human nature and saying, well, there will be something countercultural. Let's engineer it. So, yeah, she could, I mean, I'm sure about anyone who's listening to this, or probably half of the listeners have read the new Chaos Charles Manson book, which I was very illuminating. And if you haven't, you should throw Helter Skelter away. But that's another good example of, like, LSD being introduced to this country specifically for that reason. People like Leary. Mm-hmm. Well, and Wilson to an extent too, because there are all these different stories of him. Like, he did have friends in the agency and they had, like, overlapping agendas of, like, getting information out, but, like, why they want to create these subcultures of different things. At the same time, I know the CIA and branches like that were experimenting with, like, grassroots movements of new forms of social control that are very low tech. Cults, UFOs, things that can be done, you know, through hypnotism and psychology and stuff like that. So learning that he was caught up in that and like to keep company in those circles was just, it's always just like, for me, it's like, it's almost a little validating because it means like they were in this intentional network of influence that seems to have always been a part of these things. Like, Nate and I have a whole other conversation about, like, libertarian politics and the occult and how it always seems to be like that often, like with
Luciferianism.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. OTO, a lot of the Thelemites I've known, which I know Thelema today, people are trying to separate it from Crowley. I understand why, but I still find it creates a very insular, free market.
I mean, do it that well. Ideology. The whole of the law is like perfectly acceptable to the status quo.
But I'm not writing Wilson off. I think he's an important cultural figure. I think you just have to look at all of these guys with a grain of salt and understand what the goal is of the area. Like, why are they all hanging out with Stuart Brand, Esalen Institute, all of these other fascinating new age places that have, like, you know, the Mellons are paying for it or whatever that was. But for me, that's a part of, like, I guess my interest in spirituality today. I don't want to call it my spiritual journey, but like.
Throwing things against the wall and seeing what sticks is its own kind of, you know, powerful tool, and trying to generate new metaphors to diagnose everything. I mean, insofar as, you know, the concepts we use to grasp hold of the world we're living in, you know, are one of the main ways we kind of, like, structure and make the world for ourselves. So it's perfectly logical that, you know, that choosing to adopt a different kind of set of concept systems will have that effect. I mean, to maybe turn it back to some of the subjects of the recent show. I mean, I guess one of the big points about something like Mia Maya is that, you know, it doesn't require belief, that its consequences are kind of apart from the user's belief in the validity or the veracity of, you know, of any kind of
manifestation. It's just a it's kind of like a tool for abject freedom, like. These people assume an entity and then they have, like, complete lack of restraint or freedom from restraint. And, interesting phenomenon to observe.
Well, and it reminds me very much, you mentioned Legba, who I believe is an Orisha.
Yeah.
Umbanda ceremonies in Brazil mm-hmm. are very much one of allowing an orisha to take possession of yourself
yeah.
and of ritual freeing of oneself through the inviting in of a deity to kind of claim agency. So the parallels are
yeah, that are is there, interesting.
But it's interesting you saw the Baron and that was your introduction to this. Or are you already familiar with this and that just kind of pushed you further along the path?
With what is this?
Your dream with Baron Samedi and your I'll just start with like your interests in voodoo. Did it start before that and then
yeah, okay. I was I love Maya Darren, so she has her own work on voodoo and she has a book, I think it's called The Four Horsemen, and it's about her time in Haiti exploring voodoo. She has a film where she's making footage of voodoo rituals. I think it's in the 50s or something. And I had a film teacher who told me that she got into the practice of voodoo and she tried to curse someone, but she did it wrong. And so that's why she got brain cancer, because like the curse she put on somebody went on herself and she died pretty quick. Jeez. But
that's dangerous stuff.
That was the story I heard. But yes, I read maybe is it Kiss of the Spider Woman? Is that the movie? I forget. There's a book that was made into an 80s movie that's about somebody like a journalist exploring voodoo in Haiti in the 80s. It wasn't that great a book, but I just got fascinated with the iconography. But so I was exploring that beforehand, so it was in my subconscious, but I wasn't familiar like specifically with that deity that showed up.
Wow. What? Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, and then like actually like after sustaining a practice of Kundalini, like a lot of the classic stuff, I've never had sleep paralysis before, and I started having moments of sleep paralysis which were interesting. Frightening, but still like
seeing shadow creatures.
Yeah, like seeing or feeling or being aware of presences. So, like all the classic shit just started happening, and that was actually like after I had read Communion too. So he was having like some of the same kind of experiences, and that was getting me freaked out.
Do you think like some of the media that we encounter can going back to like the subjective objective relationship of these phenomena can inform them? Like you've read this book and then now
definitely,
it's
yeah I mean even something as simple as oftentimes I wish I hadn't seen I'm not really afraid of the ocean anymore, but I wish I hadn't seen Jaws, just because for like a whole long time, like if I was out swimming in the ocean, I would just start thinking about that and get scared. But eventually I grew to love swimming in the ocean so much that I stopped thinking about that, but
It's
kind of like mind worm shit that gets in your head.
Yeah.
Cognitive hazardous.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So like today, like you're knowing all of these things, where do you, is like your art practice more of where like these spiritual factors come into play, or is there something that you use to kind of guide your life? Like where are you at?
Directly in relationship to the spiritual practice?
Yeah. Kind of like this path of exploration you've had, like where are you in that today?
My interpretation is that I've been given access to the astral realm, and unfortunately, the only language I have is coming out of theosophy,
right?
Because they kind of invented all that stuff. But
I mean, I was listening to that.
Or they invented the English language for it.
Yeah. I mean, even like I've heard in other Gnostic circles, I've heard like Akashic Records recently. And I was like, oh, it's over there too. Like it's, yeah.
Yeah.
But, I didn't mean to write off everything, but specifically Blavatsky's, like, maybe you are an ascended master and you still have to fleece people to make cash. Maybe that's it. I don't know. But
yeah, that was an interesting part of the sorcery of the spectacle of their philosophy, some of those people and the leaders, Zumi in specific, because a lot of it had to do with shitposting, but also profoundly serious takes on metaphysics. But in that sense, like sometimes we would be like looking at the works of Carlos Castaneda, is that his name?
Yeah.
And I remember like some people, and I've listened to some of that on an audiobook. I never really got into it enough to listen to the whole thing, but part of that practice of intellectual and spiritual exploration was like getting an understanding of the system someone's putting forth, and then like recognizing the charlatanism of it, but even believing it after it's exposed as like a practice of a charlatan. And in a sense, like it's interesting to just, in that subreddit specifically, they were also like exploring propaganda and how that functions, how media culture functions.
Right.
And
Marshall McLuhan. That yeah. Kind of, yeah. Yeah. That was, I remember that was all very good.
And then so like it was like how a system of metaphysics that might be based in a charlatan's practice, how that can still be used as a tool for power, and some of that is related to chaos magic, you know, whatever, like what you said, whatever sticks yeah. works, but...
Very early CCRU as well. Go through the entire trash can of history, take what works, and add it up and throw the rest away.
Yeah, and yeah, I've listened to a bunch of Burroughs, like, in the past
year. Oh, yeah, too. I'm actually finally reading Cities of Red Night, his last trilogy, and that is, like... I just needed to like get back on like, you know, that's the source material for the Lemurian thing and the center of the CCRU. Yeah. So I wanted to catch up, but it's actually a wonderful, wildly metaphysical series. It's really good.
Is it a trilogy? I think I read one of them.
Yeah.
The one I read was like had a lot of time traveling homosexuality.
With the pirates?
Yeah.
Right. Because it's about, it's Libertatia. It's that colony of pirates as if it wasn't defeated, as if they actually mm-hmm. could go to war with Spain. Yeah. And
how does that exist in relationship to the trilogy? Is that like...
It continues because the trilogy goes further back in time and also further forward as well. And you go deeper into the five civilizations they talk about where astral projection was like realized. And then my favorite part, this whole thing of like, you know, killing yourself next to like a baby being born and like moving your soul back into that baby that like, and how he ties this into CIA stuff and to Glowies and like how in that book, it's like, the alphabet agencies are in on it. He's a private detective is in on it. And it oscillates between that colony, the present era, and the unifying factor is the corporation that has found a way to make a closed time loop. It's very Philip K. Dick. It's like... Yeah.
And then like fucking Gibson took that to the next level.
Yes. Yeah. But it's very Valis. Like, you know, we perceive time to be progressing, but we're still stuck in like the Roman era and we're all just getting punished and... Yeah, like that. Similar vibe.
I like that at the end of the Neuromancer trilogy when some of the malignant AI are Legba, actually.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, they're sufficiently advanced consciousness. Who's to say
they
cannot? Which is then, but then we're going back into Rocco's Basilisk and what I love about Nick Land and his whole AI deity is going to enslave the planet, have already enslaved the planet, and will enslave the planet. So do what you can now to make them happy. Yeah. And maybe it'll be your AI deity in the future. You know? It's great. It's just a fascinating concept too.
Yeah, his Bitcoin white paper was pretty interesting. Did you read that?
Yeah.
Bitcoin solves the problem of Kantian space-time.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
that's the end of it. But
oh man, yeah. He'll have another moment. I feel like he'll come around and he'll have like one throwback that'll just be like unexpected. And it won't just be like his like the tip that he's on right now, which is fine, but it's, I was watching a debate knowing he was going to join it. It was like a Zoom debate and he was like very late. And he was like, I didn't read the source material either, but I know what to talk about. And I was like, love this guy. He shows up, tells everybody to shut up and nullifies all of their points. Then he signs off and I'm like, yeah, great. I think a lot of the questions you're asking and a lot of the things you've explored, like I similarly have, Nate has, like where I'm getting to know more people who like, it's now a good time to talk about these things that people have been like fumbling through the dark for a while, pre-internet, post-internet, it's still.
Yeah. It's interesting to see like, this was more during the pandemic, but when you saw like psychologically powerful Twitter presences dunking on materialists and like that kind of became in a lot of these spheres that I was in, it's just like, if you're a materialist, like you're a joke.
Yeah.
And it's like the opposite of accepted discourse, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Like, you don't believe in reincarnation? Like, who the fuck are you?
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's very funny to hear it associated with a specific concept like reincarnation. But, I mean, the whole tangle of the way in which the superstructure and these concepts that are built on a material base go back to subsequently reinform mm-hmm. and change the material base and work together in this way. I mean, it seems like the internet is serving to facilitate the speed at which the superstructure can then like go back and reinform the material base. And so like, I understand that seeing concepts and seeing ideas kind of ripple out and have at like lightning speed and have these very immediate effects in, I mean, if it is just like a specific set of Twitter users all saying the same thing or whatever, like it can still be enough, especially if you're in that space already, to kind of feel like you are kind of playing with chaos magic, or you're seeing the results of these like immaterial effects like working in real time. And so if that is a specifically, you know, can be kind of contained within like a specific subset of Twitter users or extreme like fringe people, or if it is those kind of canaries in the coal mine that are heralding the extent to which, or like the kind of first taste of how this thing will, you know, like accelerate the processes of like ideas coming back around and changing the world, I think remains to be seen. Or it's, but I did have like one kind of question I wanted to get back to. Regarding your interest, you said, in exploring sigil work in the future. And I see a lot of similarities between the, I don't know, the point of sigil making, of making marks to affect a reality or trying to maybe crystallize something. I guess it's a fine point on what the sigil actually, you know, consists of, kind of ontologically, but I see a lot of similarity between the act of painting or the act of art making and of sigil making. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering if you've considered your paintings in that, you know, it, as being somehow related to concept of sigil making, like even before you started expressly like being interested in the idea of that, of sigil work.
I don't think specifically. Mm-hmm. It's because my dad is a painter, and so I've been, he worked as a carpenter his whole life. He wasn't a successful painter, but he always had a studio. He lived in his studio, and I've been painting like with him before I could talk. Mm. So that's where like it became natural for me to explore reality through drawing and painting. But associating it with a metaphysical practice kind of has to have a more a conscious impetus for me. But, I mean, even early on, I was drawn to Gothic art. Mm-hmm. Like, I would always draw Gothic cathedral art when I was a teenager. But I was also into graffiti as a teenager, so there was, like, two strands where I would be studying classical art, and being very interested in the lineage of Western art history, but also just exploring graffiti as well, which is, I kind of interpret it more as like homegrown logo branding, or just like personal branding. It's, to me, it's just like a folk art where you're kind of competing with capitalist propaganda. So instead of accepting advertising, you're creating an image and making your own propaganda for that image or idea or entity, which I guess relates to the whole phenomenon of network spirituality in the end. But of course, like graffiti for me, actually, I did have kind of like some metaphysical relationships with that too, just because I'd be exploring these bizarre places as a teenager, and like I went into a lot of subway tunnels.
Yeah, like the network of tunnels and trains. I mean, there it is.
Yeah, yeah. And then that, in those moments, like that was, I did get some profoundly kind of spiritual moments. And then like, even like back then as a kid, I was interested in this Greek idea of like going to sleep in a sacred spot and getting a profound dream from that. And I actually, come to think of it, yeah, I was also like down with straight edge kids, so we weren't doing drugs, but I was trying to get high off of sleep deprivation.
Mm-hmm.
And like that, obviously, like a graffiti practice helps that because you can just paint all night and then eventually you're going to start hallucinating. So that was interesting. I experienced like some interesting moments of synesthesia through that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, actually, I walked across Hell's Gate Bridge one time and I took a nap in the middle. But I didn't have a profound dream, but like that was like a bizarre moment.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
But I never went to sleep in a subway tunnel, but sometimes Ooh. You'd meet like mole people sleeping down there. But those environments were pretty profoundly interesting, just to see the buildup of history and like fucking 80 years of soot and dirt.
Yeah, trash and things left down. Yeah.
But I mean, then it's cool because stuff never gets clean down there, so you can still see like graffiti from the 40s or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Like, yeah.
Kilroy was here type stuff.
Oh, yeah. Very interesting. Yeah, I mean, it's, I remember being in a church in Italy and seeing like, oh, people scratched up this whole wall. Yeah. And you're like, you know, so-and-so, fuit hic, you know, was here in Latin, like, yeah. 1453, it's like, oh, okay, I mean, I guess it's still graffiti, but, and the idea of, like, Asclepius treating you, you know, mm-hmm. they had these special temple precincts areas where you would go and sleep in this specific place, so you would be visited by the god in your, god of healing in your dream.
Now I take that concept more seriously, so I'm, one destination I wanted to try was the Temple of Dendur.
Yeah.
It's nice because the park, the lawn is like right outside it, so you can still be in its presence. So I want to take a nap there, see what happens.
Yeah, I really like that idea, yeah.
And it's also near like the fucking building from Ghostbusters.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there it is. So
it's also right by that big, got like some Zool presence.
Yeah.
Yes, Zool. Oh my God.
Well, we're getting there. There was one other kind of topic I wanted to hit about, and it's not so much of a question there. These ideas, I was thinking a lot about like the history of portraiture, how it relates or is kind of adjacent to icon making, the creation of iconography. But portraiture also touches on, I mean, it has this whole history of, you know, of commissions, of thinking about solidifying an image in a social milieu or in an economic milieu of solidifying an image. And I guess I was just generally kind of curious if specifically the portraits in Humiliation Ritual had some relation, or how you, if you see them in dialogue with a kind of like art historical, you know, genre of portraiture.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not some of those ideas around, you know, solidifying an image or making like a religious icon or informed, or if you see maybe looking backwards, those ideas at play.
Yeah, definitely. The Black Dean Kissick painting kind of, to me, took on a Florentine feel, and actually like I'm reminded a little bit of like the silence that there is in a Piero della Francesca painting. He has, I think it's a painting of Saint Sebastian, or maybe Saint Jerome, actually Saint Jerome in the desert praying, and it's not like a big painting, it's a small one, but that has a similar one. And the Black Dean Kissick painting, that image interested me because it came like from an absurd trolling space, but when the images were created, like I immediately just thought of like the shadow self, because it wasn't really manifested in the ones that I found in too much of a racial joke. They were just solarizing Dean, so you know, he just looked like a shadow. And then I don't know if I had complete, I don't know how intentional it was that that one became monochromatic somewhat, but it was, I think I had wanted to try using silver as a color in that one. And so that also like took on like a little bit of a religious feel to it, but I eventually was using silver and then maybe like some mica and some gold pigment in it and in like successive layers of glazing. And so, yeah, it took on like this weird monastic religious quality, which reminded me of like some old saint painting. But the other ones weren't too specifically caught up in art historical ideas. I was just trying to concretize ephemeral imagery and take imagery that mostly functions like as detritus or discardable throwaway jokes, something like that, and give them a concrete form, like and a serious form and a serious study of aesthetics, which is like a kind of like a Sisyphean task. And a cathartic task as well.
Yeah,
hard word to pronounce. But yes, something that it's a goal that it's very likely you're not going to end up with an endpoint that you're comfortable with as an artist, because being some of these paintings, they took like hundreds of hours, if not like 1,000 hours, some of them. To make that off of like a meme image is like absurd in itself, but it's interesting. It's interesting because you get these images that are somewhat worthless, and then because of the meaning invested in them, and then like the labor hours and the aesthetics that I've invested in them, they take on a whole other type of presence.
Well, I think that's really the key. Is that, and I we brought it up very early on, but there are these works that I think rely on the framing device of the gallery itself as that locus of meaning making. And it's just like, no, by just translating or putting the unintelligible thing in this space where people look at things and say, ah, and make meaning, that is enough. And I think there's definitely a case to be made for the use of the device of the gallery or the recontextualization. I think has its merits, certainly, but to rely purely on that, which I think is, you know, I think we've all seen some work that is leaning so heavily on that device, which I think your work is completely, you know, completely apart from. So
yeah, the metaphysical implications of the white cube is interesting, like the sacred space it establishes, but also how it relates to our own economic value system, because you sell art out of the back of your car or something, you're not going to get much money for it. But if you put it in a white cube, and then if you get art historical traction, if you get art writers writing about it, you know, it's all these various factors that elevate the value in the society we live in. So it becomes this weird interplay, which relates to Marx's view of value as a social relation.
Yeah. I mean that. Yeah. It's
there's a theorist named Isabel Graw, and she's written a few books about value and how it exists in the art world and the larger economy as a whole. And actually, I find her use of Marxist theory to be flawed, but it has its interesting moments.
Yeah. Well, that tension between the kind of erratic or almost religious value, the intangible value of something in the white cube, seems very similar to the way something becomes elevated by positioning it in a church. Yeah. But of course, the economic intangible value, I mean, or maybe they're the same thing. I don't know if Walter Benjamin would have said that, but yeah,
it's hard to apply Marxist theory to aesthetics, because abstract labor is like a specific thing you can kind of define where how it works in Marxist economic theory, but you can't really, I mean, most artists work in a methodology that's more akin to how guild labor worked or like craftsman labor that existed before capitalism, and we're still doing that. You know, I'm putting thousands of labor hour, and there's no way of measuring the value objectively. It's not abstracted, but once you, like, if an artist is successful enough that they can kind of have like a mini factory, then you can kind of theorize abstract labor into that. And obviously there's a phenomenon of contemporary artists in the Western art world relying on Chinese labor in like these art production centers, like supposedly Kehinde Wiley, the guy who painted Obama's portrait. He relies a lot on Chinese labor, and there's rumors of a lot of other artists using.
Was Obama's portrait painted with Chinese labor?
Ooh.
I'm not sure.
That'd be pretty cool.
Interesting.
That would be an awesome
like right wing conspiracy. Like the CCP was behind Obama's portrait. That's why he's lost in the leaves.
Oh my god.
Because he used to, I remember like friends of friends who used to work in that studio, and it used to be like homegrown American labor, or like I remember I had like an Eastern European acquaintance that I think was working in Kehinde Wiley's studio, and then like I've known a lot of people who've worked in Jeff Koons' studio when he had more money. I think he's downsized a little bit, but there was. Yeah, I've like known people like since like 15 years ago when it was like 20 people in one of his Chelsea studios making his stuff. But I think recently like a lot of a few painters I've heard of have been just like fleshing out ideas, and then they send the idea over to a Chinese factory, and then they get it back as a product, and they might mess with it still. And some of them, there is an interesting component of like mistranslation and misinterpretation of ideas that can produce something fruitful, but for the most part, it's
probably an accidental. It's not intended.
Yeah, it's not intended
on the part of the artist that could to get it back.
Well, actually, some of them do play with that.
That would because that seems interesting.
That could be fruitful.
Yeah,
but most of the cases I've seen, it's just like a deadening aesthetic experience.
Yeah. If you're exploring that labor, you know, if that's the content of the work, then that's interesting. But yeah, if not, then it seems very clear where that line is, where you can start like, oh, now this kind of conforms to like a Marxian like system of value of labor production. But yeah, the artisan or the art or like these models of like, and you know, there were like workshops in the 1500s mm-hmm. too, but it fits into definitely like older models of production that are separate. Certainly from they don't play as nicely with not as easily slotted into these conceptions of how value is produced. But I thank you so much for giving your time to come on and talk to us.
Fascinating talk. I definitely enjoyed getting all into the weirder aspects of this practice.
Yeah, I'm glad our conversation. I'm
glad I got some like glowy rumors confirmed.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I'm here for. All right. Yeah. Thanks so much, Sven.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah.
Yeah.